The following message by Alistair Begg is made available by Truth For Life. For more information, visit us online at truthforlife.org.
Do I have a personal relationship with the living God? Do I have a personal relationship with the living God? It's a question to be asked not on behalf of the person next to me or people around me or people who are coming to my mind, but it is to be a question asked by myself, of myself. Do I have a personal relationship with the living God? Can I look to a point in my life, a place in time, where as a result of an encounter with God, what I once was, I no longer am? And that what I have now become is radically different from what I was then. That's the question. Now, there are many places in the Bible to which we may turn in order to set forth this kind of consideration. In the New Testament, there are obviously many encounters involving Jesus and individuals. And perhaps none more classic than the encounter of the risen Lord Jesus Christ with one by the name of Saul of Tarsus, who by his own testimony hated the thought of Jesus Christ, was very religious and yet disinterested in this group of Christian professors, and had made it something of his life's ambition to close the operation down. And we remember the record there of his encounter, which was to mean that Saul of Tarsus would never be the same again. Indeed, Saul of Tarsus was to become the Apostle Paul. But it is not to the New Testament, but to the Old Testament I obviously want to turn, which is why we've read from Genesis chapter 32. Because here we have one of the most dramatic stories in the Old Testament of the transformation which God brings about in the life of an individual. An individual who had been living for most of his life on the fringes of religion. Like some of us this morning, living on the fringes, interested but uninvolved, knowledgeable but with no relationship. Jacob was such a man. And here in this 32nd chapter, we have this profound illustration of the monumental change which God brings about in the lives of people. In this case, Jacob. Now, some of you will know the story of Jacob. You can certainly read it at your leisure, and it will repay your careful study. It is a wonderful story. It could be read with your children quite happily. It is full of intrigue and certainly will keep attention in the lives of most. I can't repeat it all for you, but let me sketch in a wee bit that brings us to Genesis 32. What do we know of Jacob? Well, we know, first of all, that he came from a godly family. Abraham was his grandpa, and Isaac was his dad. So he had a good background. He was a twin. The second one out, first out, was Esau, his brother. They were two very different people. Different in terms of their personality, in terms of their interests, and in terms of their physical characteristics. The Bible tells us that Jacob was a smooth man, and Esau was a hairy man. And when they grew up as boys and people saw them in the neighborhood, if they had the same kind of facial characteristics, similar eyes and noses, similar identifying features, the people would have been able to see them grow, and eventually as they got to a certain stage in life, they would be identifiable, distinguishable on the basis of the hairiness of the one and the smoothness of the other. One of them could grow sideburns and the other one couldn't. One of them had hair on his chest and the other one didn't. When they went swimming, it was obvious who Esau was and who Jacob was. Jacob was his mom's favorite. She loved him more than Esau. That wasn't right, but it was true. And she set about seeking to ensure that Jacob would succeed. Esau should be the one as firstborn to receive his father's blessing. And Jacob's mother decided it would be a good idea if Jacob got the blessing. And so they connived a plan whereby he would make himself in appearance like Esau. You can read of this in chapter 27. so that when in the old age of Isaac, the son, the elder son, would go in to receive the father's blessing, the mom fiddled it in such a way that Jacob, the smooth one, covered with goat skin on the back of his neck and on his forearms and on the backs of his hands, he would go in and meet his father, and he would seek to secure from his father the blessing which really should have been his brother Esau's. And it was a confusing thing for Isaac, because the record tells us that Isaac, in encountering this phenomenon, said, "This is the voice of Jacob, but these are the arms of Esau." And in his erstwhile dotage, he confers on Jacob the wrong son from an earthly perspective, the blessing which should have been Esau's alone. Now that pleased the mom, and it angered Esau, and it led to the departure of Jacob. His mother suggested to him that he shoot off for a while and go and live in the country of his uncle Laban. And he determined that, judging from the response of Esau to the events that had unfolded, it really was a pretty sharp idea. And so, as happens in family feuds, he decided he'd move a few states away, wait till things died down, and then hopefully in years to come he'd be able to come back, and the passage of time would take care of everything, and all would be well, and things would be reinstated. The story's fascinating. I commend it to you. And by the time we reach chapter 32, he has married two daughters of his uncle Laban. He tried to marry one. They did a switch on him. And when he ended up in the marriage bed with what he felt was the right girl, proved to be the wrong girl. And he was stuck with her, so to speak. And he'd waited for 7 years to marry the right girl. He got the wrong one. And then he waited another 7 years to get the right one. So now 14 years later, he has both of them. And 20 years have passed, and he decides it's time to go home. I'm going to go back. A number of things had also happened, making it necessary to do so. But by and large, he said, it's time. I'm going to go back, face the music. I'll look Esau in the face and hopefully be able to take care of it. Now, this is where chapter 32 begins, and we find him a mixture of his cunning strategy, which had been a mark of his personality, and a mixture of human ingenuity and dependency. What he doesn't know is that he's about to find himself at the crossroads of his life. For 20 years, God has been patient with him, bringing him to this point, and here he is, and God is about to show him the absolute necessity of stopping relying upon himself and his own ingenuity and coming to a genuine, heartfelt, realistic dependence upon God and his father. Because you see, Jacob to this point in his life had been playing with religion. It wasn't that he was irreligious. He believed in God. He had a heritage which almost presupposed that he would believe in God. A grandpa who prayed and a dad who prayed, and therefore, fair enough, I believe in God. And he did somewhere within his mind obviously believe in God. And he was not averse to praying. When the chips were down, he would pray. Especially if his possessions were at stake, or some of the things that were important to him. If he thought that he was about to lose any of that stuff, now he would pray. He was in the boat, and the oars had fallen over the side, and there was no prospect of getting back to the land. Oh, now would be a good time to pray. And so he would pray, and then things would pass, and he would get back on the boat, and things would be well, and then it would be over for a while. He was playing with religion. When he had left, he wanted it all on his terms. God, if you do this, I'll do this. Just like many contemporary men and women. If you do this with my business, I'll do this. If you fix this in my life, I'll do this. If you take care of my family, my marriage, my whatever, I'll do this for you. God does not deal on those terms, as Jacob was to find out. God deals on totally different terms. And here in this moment, Jacob was entering a crossroads experience. It was external to him. In the same way that it is external to some of us who sit in this room this morning. We have gone through another complete year playing with religion. We have endured or enjoyed another year on the fringes. It is not that we are irreligious. If we were irreligious, we would not come. It is not that we are unprepared to call out to God when the extremity is great enough, we do. But it is like Jacob, that it is all external to us. It is ultimately at arm's length to us. It may be up here, but it's not in here. There is a gap between the cerebral dimension and the visceral dimension. And here we sit on the final day of the year. And I put it to you, dear ones, this is the ultimate question. Do I have a personal relationship with the living God? You see, for Jacob, everything was about to change. Because the nature of genuine Christian experience is that God brings about change. Paul, when he describes it in 2 Corinthians 5, says, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. That sounds like change to me. That's dramatic change. It is not that the person was like a car that had kind of decayed, was a bit of a wreck, and somebody for Christmas gave it 2 new wing mirrors and a horn and said, there you are, now you'll do a lot better. At least you'll be able to see behind you and you can let people know when you're coming. Don't worry about all the other stuff. You're fine. For some people, that's their experience of religion. 2 new wing mirrors and a horn, whatever that might be. Something that will allow me to see what I didn't see and will be able to toot when I come around and blow and let people know, sing a hymn there and wave a hand here. No, you see, it's about change. Radical change. Whole new chassis. Whole new business. Brand new deal. I ask you again, can you look to a place or a point in your life where you encountered the living God in such a way that what you are today is different from what you were then as a result of that encounter? Don't live with the illusion that you will inherit it, that you will slide into it, that you will suddenly be caught up in it. Where's the change? Well, you say, what is the change like? How would I know? Well, let me tell you. The change that took place in the life of Jacob was, first of all, surprising. Surprising. And when God breaks into a life, it more often than not is surprising. It's in the routine of affairs. It's along the normal journey of life. And suddenly, we are encountered by the living God. The way the events unfold in Genesis 32, there's no question that Jacob was aware of an impending crisis. If he hadn't thought about it before, he certainly did when the messengers came back in verse 6 and said, we went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you. I'm pretty well certain that the messengers would like to have ended with a full stop right there. We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you. And they may well have done, you know. And he sensed in their hesitancy and in their diffidence that there was more to the story than that Esau was coming. And he perhaps prodded them and prompted them and said, is there more than this? And they said, well, yes, actually there is. He's not coming by himself. He's bringing 400 men with him. Whoa, that's quite a welcoming party, isn't it? Or that is quite a warrior force. And all that he could remember was those goatskins on his backs of his arms and round his neck. And the face of Esau, as Esau looked into his eyes and said, Jacob, you're a charlatan. You're a trickster. You're a double-faced rascal. Get out of here. If I get my hands on you, Jacob, you are a dead man. And 20 years later, he's heading back now. And the word comes, he's on his way, and he has 400 men with him. You've got a crisis on your hands, Jacob. So what do you do when you're that kind of personality? When you're the kind of guy who's able to put together strategic plans and do it well? when you've made your living and built your prosperity and your success from being able to handle most things, you sit down and you say, I can handle this. And you put together a strategic plan. And that's exactly what he did. And if you've got a kind of religious factor to you, then you do a little bit of adding the religious in, because after all, it can't hinder in any way, you say to yourself. And you remember that your father used to tell you about the fact that God was going to make of his seed a numerous company like the sand on the seashore. And so you have a prayer and you roll that sand on the seashore stuff in, and you kind of got the idea that, you know, the Lord, since he gave that idea, might like to hear about it again. And meanwhile, you're putting the thing together in such a way that all will be well. After all, you've been used to being in control. And you'll control it. Is that you at the end of 95? You've already got your day timer for 96? Oh, there are regrets in 95. You know that. There are gaps and spaces and misses and non-starts. But there's the crisis on the horizon, whatever it might be. But you'll control it. You have in the past and you will again. Maybe like Jacob, you said to yourself, you know, I think probably what I just need to get a loan. And maybe if I could just be completely alone for a little while, I could take care of this. And that's exactly what he was. He got rid of his wife and his kids. In verse 22, he got up, he took his two wives, his two maidservants, his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And after he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions, and he put himself in a situation where he was alone. Probably the way he'd worked in the past. Give me a little space, and I'll be okay. And suddenly, unexpectedly, surprisingly, he is wrestled to the ground. Verse 24, so Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. Now what we have here is a manifestation of God. It's not my purpose this morning to unpack this story for you. It is clear, though, from the context of the story, that Jacob, in a real encounter with a real individual, concluded that he had been encountered by the living God, and it surprised him. In the same way that it will be a surprise to a man or a woman here this morning, that in an encounter with a mere man speaking from an ancient book, it would appear as though, somehow or another, the man disappeared, and it was as if the very voice of God were to speak into your heart and wrestle you to the ground. And it surprised you, because you've been here before. This has become routine to you. You know how to do it. You know how long it lasts. You know what you're supposed to do. And you'll be on your way. You concluded that before you came. But suddenly, surprisingly, God intervenes. And what was to be just another Sunday morning becomes a crossroads, a turntable in your life. It may be that some of us this morning behind our smiles are facing a crisis that others know nothing of. A crisis in our home, or a crisis in health, or in business. And we're taking time to take stock. We've said that over the holiday period we would get it sorted out. We know what the problem is, or so we think. And suddenly, as in Jacob's life, God takes the initiative. God shows himself to be in charge, and we're surprised. The same way that C.S. Lewis was surprised. When, as a boy at the age of 11, he concluded there is no God. He walked out of the Anglican church service. He looked up at the spire and he said, that's it. I have had enough of this. There is no God. I'm out of here. From the age of 11 through the next 13 years of his life, he lived as a small, growing, intellectual, arrogant atheist. And when you read of his conversion, how he says, and in the Michaelmas term at Oxford University, I got down on my knees in my room and I admitted that God was God, perhaps the most reluctant convert in the whole of England. And he writes his biography on the strength of it, and he calls it Surprised by Joy. Have you ever been surprised by joy? Have you ever been surprised by the intervention of God in your life, you see? You're not going to be surprised by church. You're not going to be surprised by religion. You're not going to be surprised by whatever way it gets poured out to you. But God will surprise you. He'll come at unexpected times, and when you think you're in control, he'll show you you're not. You see, what makes a man or a woman a Christian is not something that he or she does. Don, let's be done with that before the year is out. Well, I think, you know, if I do this and I do that, then I'll be living as a good Christian. Listen, the message of the gospel is not, come on and do something and you'll become a Christian. The message of the gospel is God has done something upon which you must cast yourself, and in that God will make you one of his own. It's an announcement, it's a proclamation that God has done something, that at the cross he dealt with sin, that he punished it, that he dealt with my guilt. And on the basis of what someone has done, namely Jesus, he offers me pardon, he offers me forgiveness, he offers me a clean slate, he offers me a cleansed conscience, he offers me the best in New Year's resolutions. And God met with Jacob surprisingly, as today he may choose to meet with some of us. What was this change? It was a surprising change. Secondly, it was a personal change. God changes people one at a time, not in groups. Or you say, well, I heard a missionary story and a whole village came to Jesus Christ. I understand that. And as a result of the Spirit of God working in individual hearts, simultaneously a group came to Christ. But it wasn't that the chief said, I believe, and they all got swept in with it. It wasn't that the dad said, I'm in, and the whole family got included. It wasn't that the people at the tennis club said, hey, I'm a Christian, if you stick with me, you'll be okay. No, he comes and he meets us personally. Indeed, the encounter is intensely personal. You will notice the phrase, we come back to it in verse 24. So Jacob was left alone. He was left alone. That's why many of us don't like to be left alone. That's why some of us are consumed all the time. We need to have people. We need to have noise. We need to have music. We need to have something going on. Because we don't like to be alone. Because in that experience of aloneness, we might start thinking the issues out. And if we start to think the issues out, they will be more than our minds can handle. And so we fill our lives up. But God separates him from his wives, from his kids, and from his possessions. You see, his whole identity was wrapped up in that. Isn't yours, Mr. Businessman? Isn't that your identity? Wherein lies your identity? With your wife? With your children, their success or their failure? Their prowess in sports, their ability in education, their unique personalities, and with your business and the product of your business endeavor, all your possessions. And if somebody asks you what your net worth is at the end of 95, with a little bit of time and effort, you can produce it and you can say, this is what I am worth. Well, if you were to be separated from that for a moment or two, what would you be worth? And Jacob is separated from that. Physically separated from it. And emotionally separated from it. Because God is about to deal with him personally. And it is not unusual for God, as he works in a life, to begin to separate in the experience of crisis a man or a woman from all that represents security and identity to them. We're going through our days doing what we're supposed to do as a husband, providing, working, relaxing, enjoying a measure of success, never taking the time to ask, who am I, what am I here for, is there a heaven or anything I'd like it at all. And then all of a sudden, when the nurse comes back out from the little anteroom there with those sheets and folders that they have, and how she was so very nice and jovial at 8:15 when you came in for the appointment, and how you had that feeling in your tummy of whatever it was, and how her gaze was such a comfort to you, and when she comes back the next time, she just doesn't have that. It's just somehow gone from her. She seems a little more diffident. She looks down a little more. And inside in your gut, you begin to say, I hope this isn't bad news. And suddenly in an instant, crisis comes. And you know the car parked out there can't do one thing for lymphoma. You know that the stock options can't do one thing to extend a day of your life. You know that every baseball game unattended, every swimming meet unshowed up for is now past. And you can't go back and fix that. And God is preparing you for a personal encounter. This week in Cleveland, one of the successful gentlemen, prominent guy in the world of athletics and business, 52-year-old man playing tennis, went to the net in the midst of the foursome, said, "You know what? I don't know if I've been eating something, but I just am not feeling so good. My knees are out from under me." And his buddy said, "You know, why don't you go just sit down for a minute or two?" He never sat down. He pushed the door to the locker room and he fell down. And he was picked up and carried out and buried. In a moment. And it is such a foolish illusion to believe that you and I will go on forever. I think of friends at school when I was a teenager who lost their lives in automobile accidents. I think of business colleagues of my father lost here and lost there. And loved ones, in the midst of a year that has gone by in 1995, think of it. Three teenagers taken into the presence of God. One in that sorry carbon monoxide poisoning. Two in car accidents. And I speak to you, teenagers, this morning. And I am asking you, do you have a personal relationship with God? Not asking about your grandpa. I'm not concerned about your dad or your mom. Jacob, waking up, Jacob. Now, it was a personal encounter, not only in terms of Jacob as a person, but also God as a person. You see, Jacob didn't encounter God as some kind of concept or as an agency. People have no fear of God as a concept. As a figment of the imagination. That's why people don't mind going to certain churches, because you go to certain churches and you find that the person talks about the conditions of the world. You remove yourself from the conditions of the world. You know, you can say, "Yes, what a dreadful shame. You know, we have these political problems and economic problems and moral problems and social problems, and somehow or another, Jesus of Nazareth can fix all that." Yes, we say. Now let's get out for lunch and on with life. Good to know that somebody somewhere has got the conditions under control. And it's okay. You're part of the group. You feel fine. But you don't like to come somewhere where the gaze narrows down so personally. You better avoid these places. Where the searchlight of God's Word penetrates your heart and speaks to you directly as you live your life. And says to you, you know what? Life is real personal. Death is really personal. The bar of God's judgment is a personal spot. You will not stand there as a family. You won't stand there as a group from the country club. You won't stand there with your buddies from the bowling league. You know how you like to have somebody with you when you do stuff? You go to the hospital and say, "Would you come with me? It'd just be nice to have you." And of course it is. Or you're going to face something and it's nice to be in a group. And of course it is. But when we stand at the bar of God's judgment, we stand absolutely on our own. One at a time, the gaze of God. Now here's the deal, dear ones. If that personal encounter awaits me, and if the only right preparation for that personal eventuality is a personal awareness of God today in time, don't you think you better set about making sure of that relationship? He is a personal God. He's not an ideology. He's not a framework. He's not a collection of principles. Christianity is not about playing with religious ideas. It's about meeting God. He's not an abstract quantity. He is real. He talks with us. We hear from him. We talk with him. See, before this, Jacob would have said he knew God. "Well, of course I know God. I have all this stuff in my background. I have Abram as my grandpa. I have Isaac as my dad. I've seen all these different things." But he didn't know God. He didn't know God till God got his hands on him. And God got his hands on him and he wrestled him to the ground. And he got him at the point of his greatest weakness. I don't know about wrestling, but it seems to me that the hips are probably very important in wrestling. And that if you can get the guy there, you've probably got him. And a tremendous point of weakness there. And he put him down. And he had him. Here's the question. Has God got his hands on you? Can you look to a point where God got his hands on you? It's a personal change. When you pray, what do? Do you just close your eyes and talk? Or do you talk with God? When you listen to the Word of God preached, what do? Just sit and hope that something happens? Or do you hear the voice of God? When you worship, do you sing the praise of Him who died, upon the tree? Or do you just sing songs? Is it all external to you? Or do you have a personal relationship with God? That's the question. Why would I waste time on any other question if this were my last sermon? Not only of 95, but of life. I would rather die now posing this question than any other, for it is eternal in its significance. The change was a surprising change. The change was a personal change. Thirdly, the change was a necessary change. He had to be changed. He needed to be changed. Oh, he knew he had problems. In fact, if you'd spoken with the chap, he would have told you he didn't have problems. He had a problem. And the problem was a person, and the problem was Esau. And since he was a bit of a schemer, he thought that if he could take care of Esau, then he could take care of it all. And that's why we see his ingenuity all in the early part of the chapter. He can pray up a storm, like many of us, when his possessions are under siege. But God's about to show him that what he thought was the problem wasn't the problem, and that he needed to know what the problem really was. There are many of us this morning, and that's exactly where we are. We think we know what the problem is. And since we've moved Mr. Fix-It and Mrs. Fix-It, we fixed it before, we'll fix it again. Society thinks it knows what the problem is. The problem in the past, in the end of the 18th century in England, they needed better housing and better education and better hospitals. And so they built the social services. And into the 19th century, they began to put that into place. And coming into the 20th century, they tried to fix it up better until they had the best social system in the whole of the world. That didn't fix a thing. Because it wasn't the problem. Oh, we better fix the problem, the drug problem. We better fix the AIDS problem. We better fix the budget problem. We better fix this problem and that problem and the next problem. We can spend all of our lives fiddling with those problems, but the issue is this. The real problem wasn't Esau. The real problem was the fact that Jacob was disengaged from the living God. And until he got that put back in place, nothing else would really matter. And the interesting thing is that when God reached into his life, and when in this experience of wrestling, he puts his hip out of joint, and then he says, hey, let me go for it's daybreak. Notice how Jacob replies in verse 26. I will not let you go unless you bless me. I won't let you go unless you bless me. That's a change, isn't it? Because before, his great concern is for the camels and the donkeys and the sheep and the goats and all the other stuff, and for his wives and for his kids. And for the fact that he'll be able to have a happy dwelling there in the land of his forefathers. But now when God meets with him, he says, you know, these things are not as important as I thought they were. The most important thing to me is that I might know your blessing. You see, when God breaks into my life and into your life, he changes our perspective on all of that stuff. And Jacob thought, well, if I can appease Esau, then I'll be fine. Some of us are here this morning and for months now, we've been wrestling with it. Well, if I can fix my marriage, that'll be it. If I can take care of my job and the change in the management structure there, that'll be it. If I can just fix things in my home, that'll be it. And you're about the business. You know what the problem is. You fixed it in the past and you'll fix it again. And God surprisingly and personally and necessarily wrestles you to the ground and suddenly it dawns on you. Said, no, I see it now. The issue is me and God. And then all of that. Rather than all of that and then me and God. You've been bargaining with God through 1995. God, you take care of all of this and I'll come and I'll bow before you and I'll trust you. If you give me a good degree, you give me a good job, you give me a good marriage, you give me all these things, then maybe I'll consider coming and being one of your servants. And it's like the heavens are brass and there's no reply. There ain't going to be a reply. God doesn't work on those terms. He comes surprisingly and personally and necessarily to wrestle us to the ground. Not out of vindictiveness, but out of a heart of compassion. For 20 years, he was patient with Jacob in his rebellion, waiting for the evening at Peniel. And for others of us, he has been patient with us over many a year. He has spoken into our lives and he has shown us our need of him. And there have been little incidents in our lives that caught us up and said, "Woo, I better be careful here. Oh, I better think about that there." And yet still it's all external to us. And here we are, the final day of 1995. What kind of change? A surprising, personal, necessary change. And finally, when God changes a life, as he did in Jacob's case, it's a permanent change. A permanent change. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel." You're getting a new name. You're getting a new future. You're getting a new perspective. That's what it means to be a Christian. Pardon for the sin that I've committed in the past. The cleansing of my conscience. Forgiveness. A future. And a hope. A new name. And a new identity. The old is gone. The new has come. If we'd had occasion to interview Jacob when he was in the land of his uncle, he would have said that his problem was Esau. That he knew that somehow or another Esau and his folks were always around and always seeking to hedge him in and cage him and trap him. But the fact was that the conscience of Jacob had made a coward of him before his brother. And the one who was shutting him down and trapping him and hedging him in was not Esau. It was God. It was God. And God was closing in on him. As he has been closing in on some of us over these days. And closing down our options and bringing us into crisis. And showing us our need of him. And bringing us to the point where in our helplessness we will cry out, "Oh Lord." And in that moment, a dramatic change. You see, the lifetime struggle of Jacob has been the struggle of many of us. And it is simply this. Jacob had been struggling against allowing God, the God of his fathers, to hold the reins of his life. To hold the reins of his life. It was not enough, you see, that God held the reins of his grandpa Abraham's life. It was not sufficient that he held the reins of his dad, Isaac's life. It was imperative that he took hold of the reins of Jacob's life. How about you this morning? Who holds the reins of your life? You? You really would trust yourself to live life on the basis of your own ingenuity? Are you prepared to face the bar of God's judgment, which you know in your heart you will inevitably and definitely face? Are you prepared to face that on the strength of a few good deeds, a couple of Hail Marys and a few trips to church? Are you telling me you'll do that? How foolish. to live on the fringes, to play with religion, and to hold the reins to myself. It'd be one thing if I was doing a fabulous job with them. But deep down, we know we're not. And so the struggle was over. And God blessed him. He said, I saw God face to face and he spared my life. He said, this is unbelievable. That God would meet with me, reach into my life, reveal himself to me, and I'm still alive. He said, you know, when I think of who I am and what I've been doing, if God ever saw me in the street, I think just the very encounter with him would just snuff me into eternity. He said, I'm still alive. And the sun rose above him. If I could paint, I'd paint this. I can't hardly paint a door, so I didn't attempt it. But if ever there was a painting, this is a painting. And the sun rose above him as he passed Peniel. And he was limping. Because of his hip. There wasn't a person who knew Jacob, who had known Jacob, who was at all confused about this one issue. Jacob has changed. Jacob is different from what he was. Jacob previously didn't limp, but now he limps. And I ask you this morning, do you have a personal relationship with the living God? And if not, are you ready to cry out to God for help? Are you ready to admit defeat? Are you ready to say, you've got me? Are you ready to limp now and dance later? Do you really want to dance now and live without Christ in eternity? Do you want to join the crowd in Times Square, congratulating ourselves at the shrines of our own ingenuity, surrounded by the idols of the 20th century man, and watching this silly big ball fall from the sky, and saying platitudes to one another about who knows what? Or do you want to say, Lord, I'd rather limp with you tonight and dance with you in heaven than dance with the throng in the midnight hour and live in the reaches of hell? That's it. Have you experienced this change in your life? A surprising, personal, necessary, permanent change. And if not, then why not today, just now, this moment, as you bow with me in prayer? For some of us this morning has simply been another story of the gospel, and we've listened and it's stirred our hearts to think of God's goodness. But for others of us, it's been far more significant. It's been surprising. Never expected this. Never planned on feeling this way. It's been uncomfortable. Just how personal it's been. And yet we know this kind of change is necessary. We're glad to hear it's permanent, because we don't want to be doing it like a New Year's resolution. 1 minute after midnight and then 3 weeks later all thrown in the towel and back to the same old stuff. Believe me, he who begins a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. He gives you a new name, a new family, a new future, a new hope. And as he walked out into the darkness of that night and laid hold on Jacob, so he walks into the light of the morning hour to lay hold on men and women here in this building today. For those of us who've been on the fringes, for whom religion has been external. So what should we do Well, we should cry out to him. The same way that Bartimaeus cried out when he heard Jesus coming down the road. The disciples told him to be quiet, but he had such a sense of need. Oh, Lord Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. That would be enough to cry that from our hearts this morning. God understands. He's not interested in special prayers. The only life that will cry is the life that faces a sense of need. The only need that we will come to face is because Christ shows it to us. And so we look to Him, to the Lord Jesus, who is the author and the finisher of our faith. Father, hear the cries of our hearts this morning. For Jesus' sake, we ask it. Amen.
You've been listening to a message by Alistair Begg from Truth for Life, and you're welcome to pass this sermon along to others, but please don't charge for it or alter it without written permission from Truth for Life. This content has been provided to you free of charge by the generous supporters of Truth for Life. For additional information about how you can support Truth for Life, please visit us online at truthforlife.org. There you'll find free message downloads from Alistair Begg, as well as links to our podcast, mobile apps, and other resources to help you grow in your Christian faith. Again, the website is truthforlife.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay in touch with Truth for Life and Alistair Begg. Truth for Life, where the learning is for living.